Welcome everybody to the Aris Meyer podcast. How are you doing today? I am joined today by somebody I met many years ago, and I think in person have only met one time. I mean, one time in like a series of a week. She's really cool and she's very interesting. I follow her on social media, and I'm sure we'll get into her work at some point, but I wanted the world to meet her and hear what she has to say. Please welcome my friend, Irene Malik. How you doing, Irene?
Good. Yeah, I'm doing really good.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Yeah, everything going all right over there in sunny Seattle?
I mean, it's rare that it's sunny, so it's funny. I mean, I guess where I am, you can tell that it's sunny, but like this is very just amazing for February.
Yeah, I'm happy to keep you indoors then during the beautiful days that you do get.
Yeah, I'm right by my window, so I can like, yeah, still get my blue sky time in.
Good. I know that's important for you people in Seattle. You got to take the blue skies when you can.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So tell the people a little bit about yourself, Irene. Where are you from? Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, I was born here in Seattle in a house.
In a house?
In a house. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. My mom was really into like naturopathic medicine. So I was born in a house. And lived in Seattle till I was about 10. And then my whole family moved to Korea in 2001 to be closer to the church that they are a part of. And I lived in Korea for 8 years from about 10 to 18 and moved back to Seattle by myself when I was 18. Because I really wanted to get away from the church. Mm-hmm. and I also really wanted to like be in an academic environment that was teaching in English. Like I just, you know, I felt really dumb trying to study in a language that I didn't speak.
When you were in Korea, were you in like an expat school or were you in a Korean school?
I was in a Korean school.
And how much Korean did you know?
Well, when I was 11 and we moved there, I could read Korean, mm-hmm. but I didn't know what I was reading.
Yikes.
Yeah, so I didn't really speak any Korean, and I just got plopped into a Korean public school in the countryside.
Oh, wow. Were you like the only white person in your neighborhood?
My siblings, my family were the only white people in the entire town.
Ooh, what was that like?
I mean, in some ways it was like, it felt like I was a celebrity and in other ways it felt like I was an animal in a zoo cage, you know, like
everyone looking at you,
like, yeah. And like, make it do something, you know?
I remember when I went to Korea for the first time, it was the first time I had ever felt like I couldn't just go home. Like I was in a distant land where I was the outsider. And it was such a unique feeling as an American. I feel like America's so big that anywhere we go, we kind of feel like we're home, especially as white people. Like there's no real like areas of America where we feel like this isn't like our place, you know? But when I went to Korea, I was just like, yo, I am not Korean. I do not fit in here. But it was funny because I'm like a pretty heavy set white dude. So we would go to restaurants and the ajumas, like the older ladies that own the place, would see me and they'd always like put me near the window. Cause I guess it's good for business to see like a fat white guy eating your food. Tourists will walk by and be like, oh, that's the spot, you know? Yeah. So it was like, I also felt like a minor level of celebrity in Korea as like the token white guy.
Totally. Yeah. So there's pros and cons there, I guess.
I guess. Yeah. I'm just trying to make the best out of it. But yeah. Did you, how did you go to school? Like, did you get, accreditation like through Korean schools? Like when you came back to America, were you a high school graduate?
So I did 4 years of Korean public school. I did fourth, fifth, and sixth grade in elementary school. And then I went to a Korean all-girls middle school. And it was absolute hell. Like I hated it. Like mm-hmm. elementary school was tolerable because there were boys around and I liked boys.
Yeah.
But once it was just all girls, it just got like mean, and still like I was just so miserable, and I didn't speak the language good enough to be learning. And there were so many rules, like I had to keep my hair a certain length, I had to wear a uniform, and I was just like really miserable. Mm-hmm. And I begged my parents to let me homeschool, and they eventually did because I was a very persuasive, angry child. So then I homeschooled for like the rest of middle school and high school, and the program I did was really easy. It was like all open book exams. And so anyway, I was able to like get through it really quickly and finish, you know, I got my high school diploma a little early. And then that was enough to like get me into community college when I moved back to Seattle.
Was it like a pretty big culture shock when you moved back to America after being in Korea for those years?
Yeah, I had like visited, you know, I had visited Seattle once in those 8 years and Scotland once. So probably visiting those places was the biggest shock. And then when I moved here, yeah, some of the like funny things that I remember being like weird getting used to was like, why aren't people staring at me?
You're not different anymore.
I was almost like a little like, yeah, offended that I wasn't a big deal anymore.
You got used to being a low-key celebrity. No one wants to take pictures with you. You're salty about it.
Yeah, that, and then like because I like was totally financially like independent when I moved here at 18. Mm-hmm. I remember like when I was in these like in like Safeway and these American grocery stores, I would be like converting the dollar amount into the won, into the like Korean currency in my mind, because I was just so so vigilant about spending money, you know. So that was like a little bit like, how much do things cost in America? That was like a little bit of a culture shock too.
Oh my God. You must have felt like, did you feel like you occupied a weird like space as a person? Like, did you feel culturally Korean in any way, or did you just feel still American?
I mean, I feel like as a kid when I moved to Korea, like I never felt like accepted or like I was able to assimilate. And once I realized that that was the case, I held on to my American identity. I think more than my siblings too. And so when I came back to Seattle, it felt more like coming back to back home. And like maybe some minor things like that kind of felt like I had a Korean identity, like maybe my sense of modesty, you know?
Yeah.
But that might've just been the church too.
Yeah.
So yeah.
When you came back home, in Seattle, did you go straight to college or did you like get a job, find a place to live? Or like, did you still have roots here?
Yeah, my grandma, my aunt, my cousin live here in Seattle. And then I know a bunch of people all from the church. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of used like that as an anchor when I first arrived. Like I came and I moved in with another church family initially, you know, that was like my landing pad. And then I quickly realized that that was not going to work for me when the mom of that family would ask me every single Sunday if I wanted a ride to church. And I was like, oh, no, I don't ever.
Absolutely not.
So then a friend of mine helped me find like, yeah, a little apartment on my own. And I got to live alone for the first time at 18, which was like really cool. I was really down for that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so this was all like the summer of 2009. I got my own apartment. I applied for community college and I think I had like two part-time jobs, both in childcare, and yeah, was pretty busy from the get-go.
Wow. So yeah. Where were you at when I met you? Because I remember visiting me and my friend Danery came to Seattle because one of our mutual friends was getting married. Mm-hmm. And we stayed with our buddy Derek. Well, no, first I got picked up by my buddy Teddy, and he like took us to some cool places like Jimi Hendrix grave and like some cool shit. And then he dropped me off with Derek, and I thought we were staying at Derek's house, but mm-hmm. we ended up staying in almost like, it was like a, almost like an apartment that was being rented for college students is what it felt mm-hmm. like. Like it was just a bunch of different college people. And he kind of disappeared and was like, all right, this is my girlfriend. I want you to hang out with my girlfriend. And then I think you were hanging out with her.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I met you, I think.
Good memory.
Does that yeah. sound right?
Totally. Yeah. Derek's partner at the time, Michaela.
That's right, Michaela.
Yeah, she's been my best friend for like the past 10 years. That was like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think yeah, that's when I met you. Yeah.
Yeah,
so I had just moved to Seattle.
Oh, so you had just come from Korea that when I met you?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was like such a weird time because we were just kind of doing whatever Michaela wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Like, we were just like, we're here, we're hanging out. And then Derek mm-hmm. just dipped. So we hung out with her. And she was like, I was a little bit nervous about hanging out with Derek because I know him, but I kind of don't know him. Mm-hmm. But she was so instantly like, friendly and like fun and bubbly and was like, we're gonna do this and then we're gonna do that. So I was immediately like comfortable with her. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was so cool. And then we went to like a couple different places, and I think we went to the store, and I have this habit when I really like people, I give them nicknames. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I've done it my whole life. Almost every person in my life has a nickname that I've given them. Mm-hmm. And after I give them this nickname, I don't call them their name. It just, for some reason, I can't. And people can attest to this that are listening that know, once you have one, that's it. And it's good mm-hmm. and bad because sometimes it's like a cute, fun nickname. And some people's nicknames are just like so horrible and embarrassing. But that's what came to me. And I don't know why. So I remember mm-hmm. you. I liked you too immediately when I met you. You were very sweet, very fun to talk to. And I think we went to like an 80s party or something, and you were like dressed in neon, and I was like, oh, she's cool. Like, she likes that fun. But somewhere, maybe it was at the store, somewhere you were eating an apple. And I remember you had this big apple in your hand, and you had rosy cheeks, and you had like lightish hair. And I started calling you Apple. And I don't know why I did. I guess just because of the apple, but that has been like your name in my mind since meeting you. And you just became Apple. I don't know why, but whenever I see you on, you know, social media, or whatever, oh, what's Apple up to? Let's see what she's doing. So I don't know if you like that nickname or not. I never actually asked you. I just started calling you it, and that was that.
It's a sweet nickname. Like, I'm honored to be associated to such a wonderful fruit.
It's funny thinking back, like, what if you were eating like a mango or a pineapple, or, you know, there's so many right. nicknames you could have had in that minute. You know, you could have been Cheetos, you could have been right. who knows, right.
yeah
you could have been so many things,
right.
So we had that week, and we went to the wedding, and it was really fun. And then after that, I haven't been back to Seattle, but I saw, you know, I would like see you on Instagram and Facebook doing all kinds of things. So tell me a little bit about your journey during and after college. What did you do?
Yeah, so I did 2 years at community college, and I really loved community college. It felt like I just felt thirsty for learning.
After like none for 4 years in Korea?
Yeah, and just like feeling really like I'm stupid. Like, my grades, I'm failing every class. I'm not learning anything. I felt stupid, and I didn't like feeling that way. And so I was really, I was eager to learn and do well in school. Community college was amazing. And I remember my first quarter, I took a class on human sexuality that was just so like pivotal, because I literally had zero sex education mm-hmm. growing up. So that was cool to just have the freedom to learn about what I want to learn about.
The church we grew up in was so puritanical that I feel like the vast majority of us didn't get to take like sex ed in school and stuff like that. So we just didn't know. So when we did get older and start having relationships and like partnerships, we're just emotionally still like middle schoolers almost.
Yeah.
In an age where people kind of like already know where they're going or what's going on. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that way?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like even just like a basic anatomical understanding.
Yeah, seriously, like, for real.
Not there. Yeah.
What really spoke to you in college? Were there like certain like classes or subjects where you were really hungry to learn about them?
Well, I feel like I almost didn't really give myself like full permission to like to really study what I wanted to study until much later. Like I was a little bit more focused on like, how do I just like, I just want security in life, you know? So what do I need to study that will give me a secure job and like something that I feel like I can be good at, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So for most of my college career, my path was like international studies in Korean language.
Oh no. So you boomeranged back to Korea.
I did. Cause I speak Korean. So, you know, I should use that. And I thought like, maybe I could be like an international diplomat to North Korea and do some good in the world. And didn't like realize probably after, like a good 4 years into college that I fucking hate politics and international studies, and like writing papers about that too was just like give me so much anxiety. But I guess I think I could answer your question. Your question was what excited me, and like learning about human sexuality was really exciting to me. Learning about feminism was really exciting to me. I also took some dance classes that were really cool.
Oh yeah, tell me a little bit about that. What kind of dance did you do?
I took a tango class.
Ooh.
Yeah. Tango's hard.
Did you like structured kind of dancing? Like partner-based like structured dancing?
Yeah, when I was like maybe when I first moved back to Seattle, maybe a couple of years after, my friend got me into blues dancing,
What is that?
Yeah, blues dancing's kind of like, it's kind of like has a lot of the same movements to swing dancing, mm-hmm. but it's a lot slower and often a lot sexier.
Ah, so you're like, oh, I'm back. I'm in America now. Let's really spread these wings and see what's popping out here.
Yeah, totally.
You kind of didn't have your parents looking over your shoulder so you could explore your feelings a little bit more.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it was nice to like, have a dance form that made me feel sexy, you know? Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. But I actually never finished university too. I was doing, you know, the international studies and Korean language path, and then had like a bit of an existential, one existential crisis, and like realized that like these goals that I've had for a long time don't feel like mine. They've literally have been given to me. Mm-hmm. And why am I doing this? You know? And I ended up switching majors to this thing called CHID, which stands for Comparative History of Ideas. And it's this cool, like, it's pretty much study whatever you want, but look at it from a different perspective than it's been looked at historically.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I just love this department at the University of Washington, because it's like, it's just teaching you how to like think more critically and think outside of the box. And like, just like, what's a different way that we can like look at this, you know? And that was like, that alone was like huge, you know, like we're just not really taught. It's just more just like, here's information, remember it, you know?
Yeah, it's totally true. And even I think just in the American school system, like history, for example, the way that we're taught history is like, here's what we want you to know. Here's the timeline that we created. And then as you get older, you have to find your own books and ideas of like exactly what you're saying, other ways to look at it. And you kind of have to like piece it together. So I feel like somebody teaching you that kind of critical thinking is so important, because it kind of frees you to view things and kind of follow your own intuition and ideas a little bit. So that sounds like kind of right up your alley, kind of free thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It felt like a new skill set to be like, yeah, be able to think outside of the box. Or
where did that take you? Like, do you feel like it put you on some kind of path?
Yeah. And it was kind of a dark one, but a necessary one. Yeah. So I was like studying, I actually went to Czech Republic for 2 months and studied in this department. And we were looking at post-communist and post-Nazi politics and culture in Eastern Europe.
Holy shit.
Which was really, really heavy.
Like, yeah.
Man, just so, so sad. And just kind of put me in some dark places. And, you know, growing up in the church, I believed in heaven and I believed in hell, you know? Mm-hmm. And then when I left the church, I didn't really leave out of like, you know, philosophy. It was literally, I left the church because I was like, I want to date people.
<You know? laughs> I mean, that's the real best reason, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. As a 16-year-old, you know, that was like, that was the call. But then later, you know, in my early 20s, I started thinking about like, do I believe in heaven still? You know? And it felt like, no, I don't. And the thought of death became so terrifying that I literally wouldn't even allow myself to think about it. Mm. If I thought about it for too long, it would just like spin me into like this panic.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when I was studying abroad, I started like looking at that fear and looking at my relationship to death, and ended up kind of starting my senior thesis. And my senior thesis was, yeah, my relationship with death.
Wow.
Which, yeah, kind of, yeah, it was just really, really dark. Because I think that's when I realized, like, all of the, like, values in my life literally feel like they've been given to me by someone else. And they don't feel like mine. Mm. And so, in a way, I was kind of, like, wiping all of this, like, all the values and meaning in my life away because it didn't feel like it was mine. But then that left me feeling like I have no meaning, you know, like there's no meaning to life anymore. And that was really scary, a really scary place to be in. And I also took acid for the first time when yes. I was in that place. Wait,
in the Czech Republic?
No, I was back. I had just gotten back to Seattle. And
okay. I was like, there's only so much a human brain could take. Like, you're over here reading about Hitler and the Nazis and the Holocaust on acid. I just feel like that's damn.
Yeah.
Don't waste your acid.
Right. But I had never, yeah, I didn't really know.
Tell me about that. Tell me about acid.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect. And I just remember feeling like I'm really depressed and I can't think of anything in life that has meaning right now. But my friend was taking acid with some people in town. And I just thought, oh, well, if you guys are doing it, I'm going to do it too. Mm-hmm. And it was in this like dark, creepy basement. And it was the most terrifying night of my life thus far. Yeah. Like it felt like the fear that life is meaningless was confirmed.
Wow.
Yeah, like it was just very clear, like, yep, life has no meaning. And I just felt like I would go on these little roller coaster rides of fear, just feeling like these waves of panic, and that I couldn't process what I was afraid of, or like I literally felt like an animal that was just afraid and didn't have the like processing skills of a human anymore. I was just an afraid animal. And anyway, eventually I was not high anymore, but those feelings didn't go away. You know, it still felt like life has no meaning. And I would have all these like flashbacks to like to being on acid. And so I couldn't sleep at night. I had just the most high panic anxiety during the day that I've ever had. And it was just like, I wouldn't say I was suicidal, but I felt like for the first time, I understood why people choose to end their lives, you know? Because there was like, there was no escape from the misery, you know? And I eventually I called the crisis line, which like shout out to crisis lines.
Yeah, 100% for sure.
100%. That was like weird to do. Like someone, my boyfriend's mom actually recommended it. And it felt weird. They were like, are you in a state of crisis? And it was like, yeah, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't function, you know? And yeah, I got to see like a mental health person and a doctor. And I was on like Prozac for like a month, which initially it was just really like helpful to have some medication because it just felt like a burden was not just mine alone to be held, but that like this medication was going to help me get the ball rolling. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I'm pretty sure Prozac takes at least a month to actually start working. But the moment that I like had the prescription, I already felt better. Like wow. I already felt like I had hope.
Interesting.
Know? And I was just really afraid of becoming reliant on these drugs. So I stopped taking them after a month, and I was doing a lot of research on just like positive, like how can I train my brain to, you know, be more positive, you know? And I started like a gratitude journal, and every morning or night I would write down three things I was grateful for. And like, almost every day I would write my boyfriend, you know, he was like the one thing that I knew for sure that I loved. And I also received some really helpful advice from my senior thesis advisor. Cause I was like supposed to be finishing university and working on a thesis. And I couldn't do it. I could barely even like be around any humans without spiraling into panic. And, anyway, I met with my advisor and I shared with him everything about the acid and everything. And I was just crying. And he was like, he started crying and telling me about how he was also on antidepressants and da da da. And he told me, like, I don't think you should worry about school at all right now. Like, you should just drop everything and just try to find like one thing that brings you joy. Mm-hmm. And that's good advice. That was like, sage, super sage advice. And it took me a while to like to find something, you know, but it's kind of funny, the thing that like I realized brought me joy was, well, initially it was food. Like I still like food.
Uh-huh.
And I like to eat good food. And I really like, I would watch Anthony Bourdain's like No Reservations and all of his amazing food traveling documentaries.
Yeah.
And I realized like, wow, this brings a spark, you know, like I'm excited about food and I like getting to see how other people in the world, like their relationship with food and what they're cooking and what it makes them feel like. And that little spark, I think, helped me get the ball rolling again on like, okay, yeah, what actually brings me joy, and helped me to start like, yeah, create my own meaning and my own values. Cause it kind of felt like I had to wipe them all away and start from nothing. Mm. And like,
Yeah. Almost like you, a small death into a rebirth, almost. A new Irene had to be born.
Yeah, totally.
Interesting. So when you started getting interested in cooking and food, was that something you pursued?
More just like in a personal way. Like I'll look up recipes just for fun and try cooking new things. And I worked at like a farmer's market food booth making like Indian food.
Wow. No, Indian food is that's there's so many layers and flavors and.
Yeah, ours probably wasn't like the most authentic Indian food. It's like a white guy, you know, but it was fun and it gave me a sense of what it's like to like work in the food industry, which mm-hmm. is like extremely stressful and high paced and and dealing with like customer service at that time was like I was super young and I just felt like I was just bending over backwards for people. And
it's humbling. You learn a lot about how people interact with other people. Like, I feel like I've said this on another podcast, but the food industry, people say you should have a year in the military. I think you should have a year in the food industry just to learn compassion, just to learn how to treat people, kind of like, you know, walk in other people's footsteps. But that must have been hard for you. I mean, I've had problems with depression my whole life, and I know that it customer service has been hard for me because you just internalize. So did you feel like when you were working at the Indian place that it was helpful or harmful to you?
I mean, it was both, you know, like it did give me a sense of like confidence at times. And I felt really good about being able to withstand the amount of stress, you know, there was some pride in that. But I eventually like left because I was just like, I literally want a job where I don't have to be around anyone, you know, like I was about 22. I didn't even know what boundaries were, you know? Yeah. And so I had like, just be absorbing all this shit and didn't know how to like, have that boundary. So I eventually, got a job as a like, both gardening and as a wiring technician. Like I would build espresso machines for this little company.
Interesting. Like basic electronics, like mm-hmm. soldering, board work, like that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. And like, it didn't require any, you know, they would just show me how to do it and I would just replicate it. Mm-hmm. And I was just happy to like, to not be around customers, you know? I just would like listen to podcasts and just do my own thing. And landscaping too, I would just get to be outside in nature and didn't have to deal with, clients or anything. So I did that for a few years and that was good. But it was also like, I mean, living off of like minimum wage in the United States is unsustainable. You know,
it's impossible. Like,
it's
completely
impossible. It's super fucked up. Like,
yeah, I'm sure in Seattle especially is not a cheap place to live.
Yeah, totally. So I was like, you know, I definitely wasn't passionate about wiring espresso machines. And I thought like, maybe the gardening was, I love learning about pruning and, you know, how to cultivate space outside. But it just felt like I didn't want to like fully commit to it as a career. Mm-hmm. And like 5 years ago, I started thinking about like, what are some other, you know, like a real career, you know, what could I do? What am I excited about? And I started thinking about massage because as like, even as a kid, I felt like when I was massaging someone, I almost had like a felt sense of what they're feeling in their body. I can almost feel it in my body.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Very interesting.
And My mom as a kid, she would ask me to like massage her. And then when I was at all these like church sermons, you know, a way to like stay awake would be like trade massages with friends.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just felt like, okay, it feels like there's some bodily empathic ability that I have that made me feel like I was good at giving massages.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I had a friend and I asked him about, yeah, what is it like to be a massage therapist? And he gave me some info about that. And I decided to, take the leap and go to massage school, which was, yeah, that was 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that year in massage school was like probably the most deeply healing and transformative year, and has just continued to catapult into wow. like so much amazing insight.
What was it about, what would you call it? Masseuse? What's the word for it?
Massage therapist.
Yeah. Massage. What was it about massage therapy that you found healing?
I just think that, you know, we often like live in our head, you know,
totally.
Our awareness is in our head, and below our head, there's just this body that's just like doing a thing, you know, but I think being able to be present in your whole body and living life that way, like changes everything. Like our bodies are so fucking wise. Mm. And when we can learn to like, to be present in the body and listen to the signals that our body's giving us, like we have access to so much more wisdom, and I just find way better self-regulation, you know?
Yeah.
Emotional regulation, stress regulation. And yeah, when I was in massage school, those were some of the first experiences of being in my body, you know? And I 100% believe that trauma lives in our body. It's not just in our brain. It's like, it's in our physical body.
Expand on that? 'Cause I've heard that a lot of times from people, the trauma mm-hmm. lives in our body, but I don't, what does that mean to you? That saying?
Yeah. I think like, I'm probably not going to do a very good way of explaining this scientifically, but more in the felt sense. I think like, you know, let's say you have an experience that's really scary, you know?
Yeah. I've had a lot of those.
Yeah.
For sure.
And there's something that happens inside your body when we experience like stress or, you know, fear. Maybe it's like a constriction of the breath or a tightening of certain muscles. Sometimes those, that fear and that memory and the way that our body engaged in that moment can sometimes get stuck, you know, like we don't have the understanding or the space to process what happened in that scary moment and to like let some of that tension go. And that tension can be held in our body for decades.
Yeah.
You know,
100%.
Yeah. And like that tension can lead to other kinds of like dis-ease, you know, and turn into real chronic illness. And when you bring your attention inside your body to those places of tension or just places in your body that have been calling to you, and just being with them, I think a lot of really amazing like release and processing can happen. That's been my experience for mm-hmm. sure. Yeah.
A lot of on your Instagram, you post videos sometimes and you use words like mindfulness and compassion. And it sounds like you've interwoven those practices into your physical body work and dealing with trauma and helping people. Can you expand a little bit on what that means to you and why you choose to incorporate those things into your practice?
Yeah, totally. I'll start with mindfulness. I think a lot of like our beliefs and patterns of how we like how we think about things and how we operate in the world we get when we're infants or children, mm-hmm. We're not conscious of them. They're just happening. Like one of mine is like I have to be good and I have to be a certain way to be lovable,
I feel that.
Something like that. And practicing mindfulness, and like the way I would describe mindfulness is like slowing down to like notice your breath and like be able to notice your thoughts kind of from this like outside meta perspective, so that they don't just like go on autopilot all the time, so that you can kind of slow things down and notice like, oh, when I didn't get that 4.0 on my paper, I kind of started spiraling into this like really negative talk, mm-hmm. And I think, mindfulness can kind of like stop those wheels from going. And compassion, I think, is really important too, because not only do I need to slow those wheels down, but I also need to, once I've slowed them down, like, okay, I didn't get the 4.0. And there's feelings about that. And instead of like going into like, trying to like change what happened or change, not be so self-critical. Like I want to stop in that moment and be able to just give myself compassion and acceptance for what happened. Mm-hmm. So that it doesn't become more tension in my body.
I say, hey, Irene, I want to book a session with you, or multiple sessions with you. Do you have like instructions that you give that person before they book a session with you? Or is it all kind of like they lay down, you're stretching and massaging, and you're also kind of like talking? Like, what is your process, would you say, for how you do your work?
Yeah. So I offer, I'll do Thai massage on a mat. I'll do kind of more traditional Swedish massage on the table with oil. And the direction that the session takes is very much like I'm trying to tap into this person, what they're feeling in the moment and what they feel like would be the most beneficial for them in that moment, instead of me coming in and being like, oh, we need to dive deep into your traumas and we need to release those.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really like celebrating, finding where they're at and just trying to celebrate it. Mm. And so sometimes that means like people just come in and they just want to just receive some touch to help their muscles feel less tight. If they're feeling open, if they seem more open to it, I might ask them like, tell me more about your tense muscles. Like, what's that experience like for you? How long have you felt that way? Do you feel like there's emotions connected to those places of tension? And if they seem like they want to explore that, then maybe we would kind of talk about their body experience in a mindful way so that they can kind of process things in a body-centered way, and try to find a place of self-acceptance and self-compassion.
Wow. Do you feel like you build relationships with your patients where, some practices are just transactional, I'm sure, where they come in, they're an athlete, they get massaged and they leave. Do you feel like because of the way you approach your practice that you're building relationships like on a personal level?
Yeah. Like if people are open, you know, to like to sharing themselves, then I think our relationships are, my client relationships are very deep and meaningful. Mm-hmm. And if people also just want to come in and just like, just receive some touch and not talk too, like I'm super happy to like, to support them in that way too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think the relationships I've built feel at least really meaningful to me. And I think meaningful to my clients, because I think I am pretty good at celebrating people, you know, like
for sure.
Just, like, if you can't find compassion for yourself, well, I can, and like, just happy to do that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. I mean, so what would you, if you were in a time machine and you went back a couple years, what would you have said to yourself now that you've found this, you know, this power in yourself, this compassion, empathy, love, this mantra, this, you know, what you're doing, what would you say to young Apple, you know, 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Well, if I think about it deeply, I'll probably cry. So I'm like, well,
that'll be a first on the Eris Meyer podcast. You don't have to do that. We don't.
But I can definitely still. Well, I just think like the wisdom that has been really helpful for me lately is like, I have a tendency to always like try to better myself and like in a way like fix myself. And like these days I feel like I'm finding more ways to just practice like embodied self-acceptance. And like a small example of that is like, you know, when I have anxiety, it's very much like around my chest and around my breathing. And often I'll get stuck in like, oh, how do I need to change my breath so that I can breathe more fully? But that becomes a dangerous slope, because again, I'm trying to change myself and I'm trying to like, I'm trying to just get rid of this like tension and da da da. But it becomes very like, yeah, like I'm just hyper vigilant towards myself and just trying to like fix it, and it makes it worse. And these days I've just been practicing, when I notice that like constriction happening, I try to just like notice it and just be with it without trying to change it. Just be like, oh, okay, there's that sensation and it's there. And maybe I imagine like hugging it or just sitting with it, but really, really focusing on not trying to change it.
Interesting.
And like it helps me. Like I find that the moments of constriction feel fewer and fewer. So I think my advice to little Apple is like, yeah, I guess I would just really, I would want to like teach her that skill of, practicing self-acceptance, but in a very body-centered way, you know, not just like I'm imagining this in my mind, but I'm feeling it in my body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can only speak for myself, I guess. There was like a period of my life where I kind of just like stopped exercising. Like when I was young, I would play basketball and do all kinds of things. And I always had depression my whole life, sadness. And it was interesting. And during the quarantine, I started, you know, I was diagnosed with diabetes. So I started eating different and then exercising more. And in my whole life, I've always had like my, like for whatever reason, my trauma always manifests in my stomach. So I would have like stomach pains or like, diarrhea or whatever. It was always like intestinal almost, for whatever reason. That's like where I held my stress. But I realized that like I'd put on like music I like, and then when I had these feelings, I'd go for a walk or go for a jog or something, and it would lighten that feeling. And part of it was, I think what you're saying, where I wasn't focusing on it, I wasn't sitting with it going like, go away. It was like, I'm out, I'm moving, I'm endorphins are flowing, I'm getting fresh air. And it would like, you know, obviously it comes back, but it would help like soothe it, I think. And that was a practice that, you know, if I had met you before, I'm sure it's something that you would have, you know, recommended, right? Like, does it seem like that's the kind of like everyday application that you're offering to people?
Yeah, like I think tuning into your body's wisdom, which I think you were doing, you know, like you were, you knew that music was helpful, and just noticing when things are helpful, you know, I think is really, really important, so that you have this like toolbox to draw from. Like, oh, I know that walking and moving and listening to music kind of puts me at ease. And so knowing that that helps you and making time for it, you know, I think is, that's what it's all about.
Cool. So if people want to find you on social media or interact with you, where can they go and how can they reach out to you?
Yeah. Instagram is a good way. I'm For Leaf Healing, F-O-U-R, Leaf Healing. That's also on my website, www.forleafhealing.com. Yeah, probably those two ways.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And like I said, following Apple is cool. She does like videos sometimes that I really like to watch that are just like, you know, just reminders about kind of the practice that you're talking about. So I would encourage people to check that out for sure. All right. Before we begin the lightning round, is there anything you want to say? It's about to get crazy.
The lightning round. Wow. Yeah. I'm just really, yeah, just grateful. And this was helpful for me too, because this is a new way that I'm sharing, you know, and I can feel that my body was both like excited and nervous to do this. And I think like facing that nervousness is like exciting to me, you know, and helps me be like, yeah, to like face that fear and be even more grounded and like bring strength to me. So thanks for like helping me find that edge.
That's what's up. I mean, that's the whole point of these podcasts, is like, I just want to share my friends with the world. Like, so many interesting people that I follow on social media or interact with, that I just want like everyone to like meet somehow, you know, and like, I get so many seeds of wisdom from so many people, and you're one of them. So I'm glad that you could share a little bit about your practice and your journey. I think it's nice to just be reminded too about things like the reality of depression, and you know, a lot of people want to hide and not talk about it, especially the way that we were raised. People don't want to overshare. But it's powerful to be reminded of it, and to hear ways that people, you know, get through it. So I appreciate you being vulnerable and open about that, for sure.
Yeah, thanks.
For sure. All right. So here we go. The lightning round. These are a couple of, wild questions for you. No okay. prep. I'm just going to ask them and then you tell me what you think. Okay.
Okay.
If you could hug any person, alive or dead, who would you hug?
The first person that came to mind was my granny who passed away, my Scottish granny.
That's a good person, of course.
Yeah.
Did you visit her in Scotland?
Yeah, I visited her several times, and she was like this super tall Scottish woman who like played rugby and
dang.
Yeah. But also like I never felt super connected to her, so it would be cool to get a chance to try to connect on a more heart level, you know?
Yeah. To see what she's about.
Yeah.
Those rough Scottish grannies, man.
Yeah.
Up there killing it. Mm-hmm. All right. Question number two. If you could live anywhere for a year, where would you live?
Somewhere with sun, and somewhere where I could like probably dive into, probably Thailand. So I could just study like Thai massage for like a year. Be in the sun.
I don't know why, but when you said somewhere I could dive, I thought you were gonna be like somewhere I could dive off a cliff, and I pictured you like diving off a cliff with like a knife in your mouth, like in the movies, you know, to like get oysters or something.
Nice.
I don't know why, that's what I thought you were going with that. Somewhere you could dive. Okay. If aliens came to Earth and they were like, show us the most beautiful flower on this planet or else we'll destroy it, what flower would you show them? These are for real questions. I don't play. Dude. I'm bringing the thunder.
I'm thinking like pussy.
Wow. That is the best answer of all time on the lightning round.
The vagina.
They would just park their spaceship, throw you the keys.
And just like, look at it.
We're staying here forever. Apple, that's the best answer I've ever heard in my life.
Oh,
good Lord. Dude. All right. I might as well not even ask you a follow-up question because that's so freaking incredible. But I'll do the one final follow-up question.
Okay.
Because of your practice and because of your insight into the nature of people through your practice, what famous person, alive or dead, do you feel like you could have really helped or needs your help?
Whoa. Okay. Again, I'm just going with the first thing that came to mind.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I think Ronald Reagan was like a horrible president.
Thank you.
And like hearing interviews, it's just kind of crazy. And even like his relationship with his wife, like, oh my God, like yuck. Mm-hmm. And I just think he was a highly traumatized person too. If we could have done some like body centered therapy for Ronald Reagan, which could have helped like the Vietnam War and like so many things, like, it would have been, I mean, I don't know if he would have been open to it, but you know, it would have been cool to have. I think all presidents should be mandatory therapy, you know?
Fuck yeah. 100%. I don't know how they don't have a therapist on staff. Although the last, you know, the orange piece of shit, the last 4 years, I don't know if he would have listened to a therapist.
I know.
Do you feel like with enough time and effort, you could fix that guy?
Well, I definitely don't want that responsibility. And like people have to want it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh my Lord. All right. Well, thank you so much, Irene, Apple. This has been really great. I'm so glad that we could catch up and talk. And I look forward to seeing what you do professionally and in your videos. And I appreciate all the goodness you're putting into the world. You know, compassion, empathy, understanding, those are important things to me. And to see you amplify them like makes me really, really happy. So, thank you for coming on. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you too. You're such a good human. You connect people, so thank you as well.
I'm trying. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.